Hello everyone, this is Robin Warder, and welcome to a more lighthearted and humorous episode than usual from The Trail Went Cold. I'm currently on vacation and did not put together a new episode for release this week, so as a substitute, we decided to drop one of our older Patreon bonus episodes into our feed today. We originally put this together nearly 4 years ago in February of 2020, and it's titled Unsolved Mysteries Guilty Pleasures, as I do a countdown of my top 10 favorite, sillier segments ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, which I still find to be tremendously entertaining and are therefore guilty pleasures. If you haven't signed up for our Patreon page, we just wanted to give you a sampling of some of the bonus material you can expect to find. We have 3 separate tiers available, and for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, signing up will allow you to have access to 1 exclusive bonus episode per month. And over the past 5.5 years, we have released over 60 of these bonus episodes. Some of them follow the standard Trail Went Cold format of analyzing an individual case, but you'll find a number of episodes that are different than the norm, like this top 10 themed episode you're getting here today. Other examples of episodes like this include my top 10 favorite Unsolved Mysteries updates, my top 10 favorite Unsolved Mysteries acting performances, and this very month, we're going to be releasing a Patreon episode which is similar to this one about the top 10 dumbest segments on Unsolved Mysteries. So if you like what you hear today, we hope that you'll sign up for our Patreon for more material just like this at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. And one more special announcement. If we manage to make it to our goal of reaching 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of October, in addition to our regular bonus Patreon content in November, we'll be providing another extra special surprise to you folks that month in order to commemorate the occasion. Anyway, thanks again for your continued support, and enjoy this bonus episode. Hello everyone, and welcome to this month's exclusive bonus Patreon episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we've hit a pretty important milestone this month. February 2020 officially marks our 4-year anniversary of when we launched this podcast. So to commemorate this special occasion, I thought I'd do something a little different from the norm, and present a more lighthearted bonus episode this month. As you probably know, one of the major impetuses of this podcast has been to cover and analyze cases which were featured on the TV show Unsolved Mysteries, and still remain unsolved to this day. But of course, Unsolved Mysteries did not just cover murders and missing persons cases, and is just as well known for its stories involving UFOs, ghosts, and other supernatural occurrences. And perhaps inevitably, some of these stories turned out to be really stupid. But sometimes, the stupider these segments were, the more entertainment value they had. So that is going to be the main topic of this episode, Unsolved Mysteries Guilty Pleasures. I should point out that even though I am not the biggest believer in UFOs or the paranormal, I still really enjoy the majority of the show's segments about them, because they are often well-produced, fun to watch, and sometimes legitimately creepy. But I'm always reminded of the story of how when Robert Stack was in the midst of recording narration for some of the more ridiculous segments on the show, he would literally turn to the producer and say, "Oh, come on!" Well, I definitely say that most of the stories I'm going to talk about here deserve that reaction, yet for whatever reason, the segments about them are tremendously entertaining to watch. While the show managed to produce their fair share of segments which were just plain bad, these ones I'd watch any day of the week. So without any further ado, it's time for me to start counting down my top 10 Unsolved Mysteries Guilty Pleasures. Number 10, the Gulf Breeze UFO Incident. This one is pretty historic in that it's the very first of many UFO segments that Unsolved Mysteries produced, but it's also the one they would most like to forget. As you might know, Unsolved Mysteries started out as a series of one-off TV specials before it became a full-time series in October of 1988, and this was the very first segment on the very first episode of its first official season. But you won't find it on YouTube or Amazon Prime, and when an official Unsolved Mysteries UFOs DVD set was released back in 2004, this was pretty much the only segment that was omitted. And that's because, unlike most of their other UFO stories, this one has conclusively been proven to be a hoax. The segment revolves around a series of photographs which were taken in the town of Gulf Breeze, Florida, and featured what appeared to be a flying saucer in the sky. Once these photos were published in the paper, hysteria pretty much spread throughout the town, and there would soon be over 80 sightings from residents who were certain they had seen strange lights or UFOs in the sky. Well, at the time this originally aired, the identity of the photographer was kept anonymous, but 2 years later, an all-new, updated segment was produced, which revealed that he was a contractor named Ed Walters. And unfortunately, the update also revealed that he was probably a major fraud. It turned out that when Walters and his family left Gulf Breeze, a new couple moved into their house and eventually discovered a cardboard model of a UFO inside their attic. You'd think that someone who perpetuated a major hoax wouldn't leave incriminating evidence behind when they moved away, but apparently not. Once this discovery made the local news, a young Gulf Breeze resident came forward and revealed that Walters had shown him that model years earlier and asked for assistance with faking the photographs. For the first time, Walters showed his face in Unsolved Mysteries in order to defend himself, claiming that the cardboard UFO had been planted in the attic in an attempt to discredit him, but the damage had already been done by this point. To put it into perspective, the incident would be referenced on an episode of The X-Files a few years later, where Mulder stated, quote, "When I first saw the Gulf Breeze photos, I knew they were a hoax."
"This is the best photographic evidence I have ever seen. When I first saw the Gulf Breeze photos, I knew they were a hoax, but this..."
Yes, in this particular case, even Fox Mulder didn't want to believe. Anyway, even though Walters went on to publish a couple of books about the UFO sightings, he is now almost universally regarded as a joke who orchestrated the whole thing for publicity, though the amount of money he made by selling off his story is believed to be in the mid-six figures. When you look at Walters' photos today, they really don't look that convincing at all, but hey, since I was only 10 years old when this originally aired, they seemed a lot scarier at the time. All that being said, I still find both the original and updated segments incredibly fascinating to watch, because there were numerous Gulf Breeze residents, many of whom seemed like level-headed people, who were willing to go on camera and state with 100% belief that they saw a UFO. But I think the most logical explanation is that Gulf Breeze is located near an airbase, so most of the bright flying objects these people saw in the sky were probably just military aircraft. Under normal circumstances, they may not have paid that much attention to them, but once Ed Walters' photographs ran in the paper, hysteria took over, and they convinced themselves they were seeing UFOs. Anyway, the Gulf Breeze segments occasionally pop up on YouTube every now and then, so even though Unsolved Mysteries would prefer these segments had never have existed, I'd recommend viewing them, as they are a fascinating case study of how an elaborate hoax can unfold and fool people. Number 9. The Magic Rock. Okay, imagine sitting down to watch the episode of Unsolved Mysteries which aired on November the 23rd, 1988. It started off with the segment about the mysterious death of Kurt Sova, and shortly thereafter, followed it up with a segment about the unsolved murders of Father Ronaldo Rivera and Father John Kerrigan. These are two of the most fascinating stories ever featured on the show, so much so that I've actually covered both of them on The Trail Went Cold. So I guess it's only appropriate that they would close this episode off with an equally fascinating story about a magic rock which brings a family good fortune. Oh, okay, that's kind of an anticlimactic way to end the show. Anyway, the story goes that a 13-year-old boy named Trevor Johnson went into the woods one day in Washington State and came across a rock which was described as having strange, cryptic, alien-like drawings on it, and he became so fascinated by it that Trevor brought his father back to see it. Now, at the time, the Johnson family were struggling financially, but only 2 days after laying eyes on the rock, their fortunes began to turn around in a huge way, as they wound up acquiring some successful businesses, including a movie theater, and they soon moved into a new house. And it was all thanks to the magic rock. I gotta say, I have a feeling that the Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter must have lit up that night after the segment aired from viewers who were phoning in tips. I mean, for the past 4 years, I have been attempting to put together a Trail Went Cold episode about this story, but I just think the mystery is so baffling and complex that I really don't think I could do it justice. Okay, all sarcasm aside, as silly as this entire segment is, there's something oddly charming and irresistible about it. Let's face it, Unsolved Mysteries did not want their viewers to be depressed and disturbed for the entire hour, which is probably why their heartwarming lost love segments were such a big part of the show. You need a little variety, and the show would sometimes feature light human interest stories such as this. The deaths of Kurt Sova, Father Rivera, and Father Kerrigan are pretty dark stories, so why not end the episode on an upbeat note? While I do think that Unsolved Mysteries became oversaturated with segments like this during the mid-1990s, it was sometimes a nice change of pace for them to present a happy story every now and then. The Johnsons really did seem like nice, likable people, so if they want to believe that a magic rock helped change their life for the better, who am I to question them? Incidentally, a while back, I held a live watch-together event for our listeners in which we marathoned a whole bunch of Unsolved Mystery segments about cases which were covered on The Trail Went Cold. At the very end, McGill and I decided to surprise everyone with a little bonus segment and hyped it up as the scariest, most disturbing story they would ever see, and sure enough, it was the Magic Rock segment. I'm sure our listeners were sleeping with the lights on that night. Number 8. Dr. Ivan Browning, the Climatologist. I'm sure most of you are familiar with the San Francisco earthquake of 1989. Hell, if you were around back then and you were a baseball fan like me, you might have memories of witnessing the earthquake unfold during a live broadcast of Game 3 of the World Series that year. But do you remember the New Madrid earthquake of 1990? You don't? Well, that's probably because it never happened, and this is the reason I'm guessing most of you have not even heard of this particular Unsolved Mystery segment. Dr. Ivan Browning was known as a self-proclaimed climatologist because of his supposed ability to predict national disasters, including earthquakes. On November 7, 1990, Unsolved Mysteries aired an episode containing a segment about Dr. Browning, in which he predicted the possibility of a major earthquake taking place along the New Madrid fault line, which stretched through Missouri, Arkansas, and Tennessee. There was precedent for this, as a devastating series of earthquakes took place along the fault line in late 1811 and early 1812, and Dr. Browning predicted there was a 50% chance of such an event happening again, and that it could absolutely devastate the Midwest. Well, the problem was that Browning claimed the earthquake would take place on December the 2nd or 3rd, only 4 weeks after the segment originally aired, so needless to say, the whole thing became completely irrelevant in record time, and I'm not sure this segment ever aired again. I mean, what was the show supposed to do? Have Robert Stack say, "Update, a whole lot of nothing happened." I think the main reason Unsolved Mysteries decided to give this guy airtime is because Browning had allegedly called the San Francisco earthquake 5 years in advance, predicting heavy seismic activity in Northern California on or around October the 16th, 1989, which is just 1 day before the earthquake actually occurred. You could say that Unsolved Mysteries was being very irresponsible by airing this segment, and potentially causing fear and hysteria among people who lived around or near the New Madrid fault line, as many experts believe that Browning's predictions were based on nothing more than pseudoscience. But to be fair, Unsolved Mysteries weren't the only ones doing this, as Browning's predictions got coverage in the national media, so there were reports of numerous people from the Midwest either leaving the area or stocking up with supplies in order to prepare for the big one. I have to wonder if the producers of Unsolved Mysteries might have thought twice about making this segment if they knew that Dr. Browning was once a major advocate for arming whales with hydrogen bombs to turn them into nuclear weapons. Yes, he really wanted to do that. When the earthquake wound up not happening after all this hype, the National Anxiety Center would present Browning with their first ever Chicken Little Award. For obvious reasons, this is one of the more rare Unsolved Mystery segments, and it's not available for viewing on YouTube or Amazon Prime, but if you happen to come across it, I recommend it because it's absolutely hilarious to watch today. The whole thing is pretty much worth it because they actually have Robert Stack provide a PSA at the end where he shares safety tips about how to prepare for the upcoming earthquake, which I'm sure must have legitimately frightened some viewers. I mean, in 1999, Stack was actually hired to be the host of an instructional video about how to prepare for the Y2K crisis, and well, we know how that one turned out. So if you ever want to put the fear of God into someone about a non-existent disaster which never happened, Robert Stack is the guy to do it. Number 7. The story of Kevin Paulson, aka Dark Dante. Now, this is a segment I wouldn't exactly call stupid, but it was definitely a product of its time, and pretty much unlike any other story Unsolved Mysteries ever ran. If you've ever seen the movie War Games, the best way you could probably describe Kevin Paulson is that he was a real-life version of Matthew Broderick's character. When he turned 16 years old, Kevin received his first computer and became fascinated with the concept of hacking, and wound up doing so under the pseudonym Dark Dante. One of his first escapades was hacking into the Advanced Research Projects Agency Network, aka ARPANET. So yes, Dark Dante was pretty much hacking the internet before the internet even existed. At one point, he hacked into a computer network containing secret military research being conducted at the University of California, Berkeley. But I wouldn't say it was too much of a challenge, since all Kevin had to do was guess their password, which was literally the university's initials, UCB. I mean, they may as well have used the password 12345. Anyway, Kevin kept on hacking into military databases and computer systems, and this became so serious that the FBI got involved, as they even suspected that he might be involved in espionage and working as a secret spy for the Soviet Union. Kevin would be arrested and indicted on 19 separate charges, but jumped bail and disappeared, which is why he was featured as a wanted fugitive on Unsolved Mysteries. Though in retrospect, he may have been the least menacing fugitive they ever profiled. Not that I'm questioning the decision to feature Dark Dante's story on the show, as Kevin's crimes were pretty serious at that time, but the segment is quite amusing to watch today. Not only is it a nirvana of outdated 1980s computer technology, but it has this over-the-top feeling of Cold War-era paranoia. Knowing what we do now, it's pretty clear that there was never any danger of Kevin being a double agent who would sell military secrets to the Soviets, as it seems he was just a very curious kid who did all this hacking for fun. Now, what's crazy is that when this was originally aired on Unsolved Mysteries in October of 1990, through toll-free phone lines, you know the number, 1-800-876-5353, they mysteriously crashed. But 6 months later, Kevin was recognized frequenting a Los Angeles supermarket, and since he was a regular customer there, the FBI set up a sting operation. Sure enough, Kevin eventually returned, and the reenactment Unsolved Mysteries film for the update is quite hilarious, as Kevin is getting his items rung up at the cash before these two clerks take the initiative to tackle him and keep him detained until the FBI shows up to arrest him. Kevin wound up being sentenced to 54 months in prison, but the good news is that this story ultimately had a happy ending. Unlike most Unsolved Mysteries cases involving wanted fugitives, this one wound up changing his life for the better. After his release from prison, Kevin went on to become a journalist who won numerous awards, and he's currently a contributing editor for the Daily Beast. At one point, he even wrote some computer code, which was able to match MySpace profiles to 744 registered sex offenders who were using the website to solicit sex from children. So good for Dark Dante. In the end, it's reassuring to know that Kevin Paulson ultimately used his hacking skills to become a productive member of society, rather than accidentally starting a nuclear war. Number 6. The Cokeville Elementary School Explosion. Now, I mentioned earlier that the mid-1990s were not the best time for Unsolved Mysteries, as they got pretty oversaturated with ridiculous segments, many of which involved alleged miracles. Years ago, they released a 4-disc Unsolved Mysteries Miracles DVD set, which I wound up buying, and later wound up giving away. I don't mind these miracle segments in small doses, but let me tell you, watching 4 discs worth of them wears thin awfully fast. But God help me, I actually really like this particular segment. I know a lot of fans don't feel the same way, and this one is pretty infamous. In fact, whenever they aired Unsolved Mysteries episodes in syndication on the Lifetime Network, they apparently loved to show this one all the time, so whenever it popped up, viewers would scream, "Not Cokeville again!" Anyway, the story involves a former police officer and white supremacist named David Young, who, along with his wife Doris, decided to invade an elementary school in the small town of Cokeville, Wyoming, and took 136 children and 17 teachers hostage inside a classroom. Young attached the trigger from a large bomb to his wrist and threatened to blow everyone up if the authorities didn't give in to his demands. Well, at one point, Young attached the bomb's trigger to his wife's wrist, but she accidentally set off the detonator and caused the bomb to explode. While Young responded to this disastrous turn of events by fatally shooting his wife before turning the gun on himself, remarkably, they would turn out to be the only casualties that day. Even though a number of the hostages were wounded by the explosion, none of them were killed. You might be wondering why a story like this would even be featured on Unsolved Mysteries, but that's because some of the children claimed they saw angels in the classroom that day who protected them from the explosion and ensured that no innocent lives were lost. Indeed, the segment even shows an actual police photograph of the crime scene featuring a weird image which some people believe is an angel. While there are a number of logical explanations for the lack of casualties, such as the bomb just being poorly assembled, most people who were there that day have clung to the idea that a genuine miracle took place. Now, I have to concede that the main reason I still enjoy this segment is because even if you're a complete skeptic and reject the whole divine intervention angle, this is still a pretty remarkable story. I mean, Cokeville is a town of just over 500 people, so if the bomb had gone off and killed all the children in that classroom, we're talking about pretty much wiping out an entire generation, and the community never would have recovered. When everyone outside heard the bomb go off, they must have thought their absolute worst nightmare had taken place, only for them to discover that everyone survived. Even though I don't believe there's much of a mystery per se in this Unsolved Mystery story, I can't really object to their decision to share it, and if the people who went through this experience want to believe that God's angels reached down and protected everyone, who am I to question their faith? But another reason I like this segment is because the actor they hired to play David Young in the reenactments was veteran B-movie icon Bill Moseley, who has starred in a number of horror films and is probably best known for playing the role of Otis B. Driftwood in Rob Zombie's House of 1,000 Corpses and The Devil's Rejects. The casting of Moseley in this reenactment is pretty unusual, since Unsolved Mysteries often like to cast unknown, non-professional actors, but Moseley had already appeared in a number of films by this point, including The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But hey, maybe he was just a huge fan and wanted to live out a fantasy of appearing on Unsolved Mysteries, and par for the course with Moseley's work, he is pretty good at playing a psychopath here. So overall, even though this might be the most overexposed Unsolved Mysteries segment of all time, I still have a soft spot for it. Number 5. The Guardian UFO. This is another UFO segment from Unsolved Mysteries which many people believe was a hoax, though I don't think it has officially been debunked. But the main reason it cracked this list is because it's pretty close to home for me, as this alleged sighting took place in the township of West Carleton, Ontario, Canada, a rural area located just outside the city of Ottawa, which is where I currently live, and I know I have driven through this location numerous times. The story involves a woman named Diane Labanek, who looked out the window of her farmhouse one night and thought she saw bright lights from a UFO touching down in a nearby field next to some flames, before it soon took back off again and disappeared. Months later, a UFO researcher named Bob Exler received a mysterious package containing a VHS tape which was affixed with a label featuring a fingerprint and the name Guardian. When Exler watched the tape, it showed handheld footage from a video camera of what appeared to be bright lights from a UFO in a dark field next to some flames, and once he learned of Diane Labanuk's reported sighting in West Carlton, he figured out that this was actual footage of the incident. So when this segment originally aired in February of 1993, it just blew my mind, because not only did it contain actual filmed footage of a UFO, but it also took place in Canada! The segment even made allegations of a conspiracy involving the Canadian military, as there were reports of unmarked helicopters flying over West Carlton following the appearance of the UFO. One of the major highlights for me are the interviews with Major N.J. Patterson of the Canadian Forces, who denies that the military was covering anything up, and he does so in the most polite-sounding Canadian accent. To add even more Canadian flavor to the segment, there's even an appearance by a Canuck UFO researcher named Graham Lightfoot, though as far as I know, he was of no relation to Gorn Lightfoot, but he does say a few times when he speaks. But yeah, as mind-blowing as this segment may have seemed to me at the time, the consensus now seems to be that the UFO on Guardian's videotape was nothing more than a truck with flashing lights on top of it, which they were able to pass off as a UFO because the footage was filmed from a distance in a dark, remote field. It's now suspected that the mysterious Guardian was a Canadian UFO enthusiast named Bobby Charlebois, who was a friend of Diane Labanuk's, and conspired with her and possibly some other people to create this elaborate hoax. While the Guardian videotape had a fingerprint on the label, Charlebois apparently dodged every attempt for the authorities to take his fingerprints. I won't get into the whole story here because it's a major rabbit hole, but if you do enough searching online, you'll find quite a few websites with a ton of additional information not mentioned in Unsolved Mysteries, and they make a convincing case for the whole Guardian episode being a hoax. Apparently, Bob Exler figured out it was a hoax relatively quickly, but still ran with it because he thought the whole story might make him rich. But thankfully, our friendly Canadian UFO researcher Graham Lightfoot got to the point where he confronted Exler and told him he wanted nothing to do with it. The mid-1990s were a time period when UFO mania was running wild, thanks to stuff like The X-Files and Alien Autopsy and Independence Day, so this segment is definitely a relic from that era. And yeah, when viewed today, the Guardian videotape does not look convincing at all. Indeed, one of the main reasons people have become more skeptical of UFOs over the past two decades is because we now have the technology to record videos whenever we want with our cell phones, yet UFO sightings just seem to have dropped. All that being said, I still have a fondness for the segment, mostly because this story takes place in a location I know very well. And I must say, it's probably a good idea that I didn't live in Ottawa back in 1993, because I was at the age where I might have been compelled to go on some excursions into West Carlton to search for UFOs. Number 4. The Murder of Sammy Wheeler. Now, I thought long and hard about whether to consider this a guilty pleasure, because unlike the other segments on this list, this was an actual murder in which someone lost their life. It involved a man named Sammy Wheeler who was shot 6 times while parked in his car at the George Washington National Forest in Virginia. Spoiler alert, the crime eventually wound up being solved, so I guess it's okay to laugh at this segment today, because Unsolved Mysteries' approach to this story was unique, to say the least. Quite frankly, there were times when this segment felt more like an episode of the Jerry Springer Show. It contained interviews with 3 potential suspects, Sammy's twin brother, Danny Wheeler, Sammy's girlfriend, Pat Mead, and Pat's ex-husband, Bob Bean. To put it mildly, all these 3 people are characters who had a lot of drama going on in their lives, so they did not hesitate to do some mudslinging and accuse each other of being responsible for Sammy's murder. We have Danny believing that Bob killed Sammy because he was angry about losing his ex-wife to him, we have Bob accusing Pat of being responsible for the murder, and we have both Bob and Pat suspecting Danny of killing his own brother because he was secretly in love with Pat. On the surface, this might seem like a compelling whodunit, but there's only one problem. Danny, Pat, and Bob all had pretty solid alibis for the time period Sammy was killed, and law enforcement pretty much completely eliminated each of them as suspects before the Unsolved Mysteries segment even aired. So this meant that the accusations they were making towards each other in their interviews were completely pointless. Sure enough, a couple years later, a suspect named Guy Jackson Price was charged and convicted of Sammy's murder, as it turned out the motive for the crime was robbery, and Sammy was just a victim of random violence from a stranger he didn't even know. If Sammy's murder was still unsolved today, the Unsolved Mysteries segment might not seem as funny, but when you watch it knowing that Danny, Pat, and Bob had nothing to do with the crime, it comes across as absolutely hysterical. I mean, this segment is 60 minutes long, but if they had just stuck with the facts of the case and cut out all the personal drama, it probably would have been a quarter of that length. Bob Bean just seems like a completely insufferable shit disturber, as he and Pat had two young sons together, and Pat was watching them on the night Sammy was killed. But Bob claimed that his son shared some incriminating statements with him to suggest they had visited the crime scene with their mother that night. He even went so far as to videotape his kids sharing their story and turn the tape over to the police, but they did not find the boys' statements to be reliable and suspected that Bob had coached them, which should give you a good idea of what a prick he is. But in spite of this, Bob maintains during his interview that he wasn't jealous that Sammy took his ex-wife, stating, quote, "I knew what I had, and I was glad to pass it on," end quote. He even goes so far as to say that he felt sorry for Sammy and had wanted to let him know what he was getting into. What a douchebag. But the highlight of this segment is definitely Danny Wheeler, who provides some of the funniest lines ever heard on Unsolved Mysteries. When asked to address the allegations that he murdered Sammy because he was in love with Pat, here's what Danny said.
There's not an ounce of truth in those allegations. If she married my brother, she was going to be like a sister to me. And my family doesn't go in for incest. She never once physically attracted me, even before Sam got involved with her. I didn't think she was a good-looking woman.
But here's Danny's most memorable line.
I believe Bob Bean had a motive to kill my brother. Pat's divorce from Bob was going to be final on Tuesday. They were going to be married on Thursday. Sammy was killed on Sunday. Just by coincidence. Just by coincidence. Sure it was. Sure it was a coincidence. Sure it was. And I'm Michael Jordan, too. I used to play for the Chicago Bulls.
Wow, to this day, if you quote that Michael Jordan line to an Unsolved Mysteries fan, they'll immediately know what you're talking about, and I can't even hear Michael Jordan's name today without thinking of Danny Wheeler. In fact, they're currently making a sequel to Space Jam with LeBron James, but personally, I think they should cast Danny Wheeler in the lead role instead, because that movie would make all the money. Anyway, I get the feeling that even though Unsolved Mysteries was well aware that Danny, Pat, and Bob were all cleared as suspects, they also knew their interviews would make for great television. I mean, this is another mid-1990s segment, a time period when trashy talk shows were extremely popular, so they decided to put together a segment which was nothing more than a bunch of false accusations and red herrings, but still an amazing piece of entertainment. Number 3. The Reincarnation of Georgia Rudolph. Unsolved Mysteries did their fair share of segments about people who believed they had been reincarnated because they were having strange dreams or visions of what appeared to be a past life. Their most extensive segment had to be the story of Georgia Rudolph, a middle-aged nurse from Macon, Georgia, who had been plagued by strange recurring dreams and visions since childhood, which often manifested themselves as memories. But curiously, these visions contained enough unique details, such as horse-drawn carriages and old-fashioned riverboats, to suggest the events occurred around the turn of the 20th century, decades before Georgia was even born. She also seemed to have visions of the same girl at different stages of her life, and after undergoing regressive hypnosis, and doing some additional research, Georgia became convinced she was the reincarnated spirit of this girl. She believed the girl in question was Sandra Jean Jenkins, who hailed from the town of Newport, Ohio, but took her own life in 1914 at the age of 19. The story goes that Sandra Jean was pregnant at the time and had recently lost her fiancé, Tommy Hicks, in a drowning accident, so she just could not bear the idea of going on living as an unwed mother and decided to drown herself. Now, this entire segment is 25 minutes long and literally takes up half the episode it was featured on, and from a production value standpoint, this is one of the best segments Unsolved Mysteries ever made. The cinematography is gorgeous, the editing is masterful, the music is haunting, and the whole thing is incredibly atmospheric. The reenactments of George's visions from the early 20th century have great period detail and an almost hypnotic quality to them. The segment is so well done that whenever I watch it, I always get sucked in and suspend my disbelief, and am more than willing to believe that Georgia is the reincarnated spirit of Sandra Jean Jenkins. But there's one moment which causes the entire story to fall apart once you start thinking about it. One of George's recurring dreams involves a young girl whom she believes is Sandra Jean walking through a cemetery behind a church and arriving at a grave, but Georgia said she would always wake up before she got to see the headstone. Well, Georgia eventually found the real church and cemetery in Newport and walked to the grave in question, where she saw that the name on the headstone was Mary Bevan Green, whom she believes was Sandra Jean Jenkins' grandmother. Georgia also had recurring visions of a house in the area, which she discovered was once owned by Mary Bevan Green, and one of Mary's relatives even provided Georgia with a photograph of a family reunion at the house in 1908, where Georgia saw an unidentified young girl standing in the background whom she was convinced was Sandra Jean. It seems like all the pieces had finally come together, but there's one major problem. Mary Bevan Green's headstone lists her year of death as 1939. So wait a minute. If Sandra Jean Jenkins drowned herself in 1914, then why would Georgia be having visions of Sandra Jean visiting Mary Bevan Green's gravestone when she did not actually die until 25 years later? Yeah, this is such a significant plot hole that it causes Georgia's story to completely collapse for me. I'm not saying that Georgia deliberately made the whole thing up, but it's possible her dreams and visions just didn't have any basis in reality. Or maybe she was just a complete fraud all along. Ironically, even though this is the last Unsolved Mysteries segment you'd ever expect to see an update for, a guy named Jack Turnock watched the episode and actually contacted the show to say that he believed he was the reincarnation of Sandra Jean's deceased fiancé, Tommy Hicks, and had many of the same visions that Georgia had. Believe it or not, the show soon did an update where Jack went under regressive hypnosis with a clinical psychologist who became convinced he was telling the truth. So this just adds another bizarre element to this story. Anyway, Georgia Rudolph would pass away in 2013, and I'll be kind and resist the urge to make any reincarnation jokes. All that being said, as skeptical as I might be about her, I still maintain that this is one of the most well-produced Unsolved Mystery segments. Even after everything I just told you, I'm sure that the next time I sit down to watch the segment, I'll become completely transfixed by it all over again. Number 2. The Lake Wales Haunting. So you knew I was going to include a ghost story on this list, and this one pretty much redefines the term guilty pleasure. Unsolved Mysteries presented a lot of ghost segments, and regardless of how believable the stories were, most of them were very well done, and sometimes legitimately scary. Hell, thanks to the Tallman's Ghost segment, I still have an irrational fear of bunk beds to this day. One thing I will say about many of the people featured in these ghost segments is that even if you don't necessarily believe that they had a paranormal experience, you often still believed that they believed they had a paranormal experience. A lot of them came across as normal, level-headed individuals, and you didn't get the sense that they were the type of people who would make up a story about having seen a ghost. But the people in the Lake Wales Haunting segment, they came across as exactly the type of people you would expect to make up a story about having seen a ghost. As a result, this segment is pure comedy gold. This one originally aired on their Halloween special in 1993, and it involves a couple from Lake Wales, Florida named David and Sandra Mann, who believe their house was haunted. Their 19-year-old son Alan had the first paranormal experience when he woke up one day and saw what appeared to be the ghost of a woman standing in his bedroom doorway. Shortly thereafter, Robert Stack pretty much sets the tone of the segment when he says,
"When Alan Mann of Lake Wales, Florida began claiming that he had a ghost in his bedroom, his parents poo-pooed the idea that their house was haunted."
Yes, Mr. Stack is probably one of the only people in human history who could say the word poo-pooed with a straight face and make it sound dignified. Anyway, Stack soon raises a few eyebrows when he casually mentions that Alan was living at his parents' house with his 16-year-old bride, Linda. I mean, since Alan was only 19 when they got married, I guess that's not too weird. But imagine getting married at age 16 to a guy who was still living at his parents' house, and said house turned out to be haunted to boot. Anyway, the couple responded to the haunting by using a Ouija board, and during her interview, Linda actually says, "The board talked real good with me." Well, that's because it wound up spelling out the name Kramer. No, not that Kramer. This is Robert Stack we're talking about here, so this is who I'm thinking about.
Get me Rex Kramer.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the comedy classic Airplane, and God help you if you haven't, Robert Stack played the role of Rex Kramer. I mean, if Rex Kramer was haunting your house, that probably wouldn't be too bad, because if Jehovah's Witnesses or religious zealots ever showed up uninvited at your front door, he would just beat them up for you. Anyway, David Mann would soon hear a mysterious voice utter the name Isabella, which convinced everyone that the ghost Alan had seen was a woman named Isabella Kramer, though no records could be found of anyone by that name having lived in the area. So the segment's highest point of comedy is when Linda allegedly gets possessed by a demon and tries to have rough sex with Alan. We get this hilarious reenactment where the couple are in bed watching TV together when Linda starts letting out this evil laugh and making weird noises before she pins Alan down and attempts to have her way with him. Alan manages to fight Linda off and slams her against the wall to snap her out of her trance, and Linda would apparently have no memory of the entire ordeal. The part of the reenactment which really cracks me up is how when Linda starts letting out her evil laugh, the very first thing she does is grab this large bowl of popcorn that Alan is holding and gently places it down on the floor before she climbs on top of him. So at least we know she was possessed by a very courteous demon who didn't want to make a mess and spill popcorn all over the bed. Needless to say, the Mann family come off as pretty flaky, and this is definitely one of the least believable ghost stories the show ever presented. I previously mentioned how Robert Stack was often pretty skeptical about many of the supernatural-themed sequences he was forced to narrate, but you can really sense the sarcasm in his voice on this one, particularly this line.
"A spiritualist told the Manns to pour salt all around the house. A number of snails were sacrificed, but the ghost stayed on."
Anyway, the Manns decided to move out of their haunted house, but I'm sad to report that Alan and Linda's marriage did not survive the whole demonic possession thing, and they eventually got divorced. But yeah, even if you're the type of person who normally skips all of the show's paranormal segments, you should at least give this one a viewing, because it's quite hilarious. And without any further ado, number one, The Saga of Don Decker, aka Rain Boy. Yes, this is the one about the guy who supposedly had the ability to make it rain indoors with his mind. I know, it sounds completely ridiculous, but there's just something about this story that I find absolutely fascinating. In case you're not familiar with it, Don Decker was a troubled 21-year-old from Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, who was serving time in the county jail for receiving stolen property, but was allowed a temporary furlough in order to attend his grandfather's funeral. What people didn't know is that Don's grandfather had abused him when he was a child, and his pent-up rage about the whole situation seemingly caused an evil force to manifest itself inside Dawn. Later that night, while staying over at a friend's house, Dawn went into a trance and water started leaking from the ceiling and the walls. The water materialized out of nowhere inside a room with no pipes, so this obviously wasn't a simple plumbing problem. Later on, when Dawn's friends took him to a nearby restaurant, the dripping water suddenly disappeared from the house, but it soon reappeared at the restaurant and started dripping from the ceiling while Dawn was there. Dawn soon returned to the county jail to finish serving out his sentence, and guess what? Water just suddenly appeared out of nowhere inside his maximum security cell. Dawn was now convinced he had unexplained powers, so one of the guards sarcastically told him to make it rain inside the warden's office, and sure enough, at that exact moment, water suddenly materialized out of nowhere on the warden's shirt while he was sitting at his desk, even though Dawn was not even in the room. Things were now so out of control that people were convinced that Dawn had been possessed by the devil, so a priest was brought in to see him in a private room at the jail. When Dawn started generating rain and a mysterious mist in front of him, the priest read a passage from the Bible. This made the rain stop, and the strange incidents finally came to an end for good, but Dawn Decker would forever be marked by his nickname, Rain Boy. The whole segment is about 20 minutes long, and yes, it is as cheesy as it sounds, and Unsolved Mysteries fans often rank it as one of the goofiest stories ever featured on the show. But here's the thing. How do you come up with a logical explanation for what happened? Yes, you could easily assume that this was all an elaborate hoax concocted by Dawn and his friends, but how exactly would they have pulled this off? What makes this segment stand out is the amount of people who are willing to go on camera and swear that they witnessed these events take place. And we're not talking flaky people here. We're talking about no fewer than four seemingly level-headed, credible-sounding police officers who claim they saw it raining inside the house and have no explanation for it. In fact, two of them recount an incident where they put a crucifix in Dawn's hand, which wound up burning him before he was levitated off the floor and thrown across the room, and claw marks suddenly appeared out of nowhere on his neck. Even if Dawn somehow orchestrated all the leaking water at the house, how could he have done the same thing inside a public restaurant and a maximum security jail cell? Once again, the jail warden, who seems like a pretty down-to-earth guy, he went on camera during this segment and swore that water suddenly started appearing on his shirt for no reason. I don't see why all these different witnesses with nothing to gain would intentionally lie about something like this. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that Dawn was really possessed by the devil and given the ability to make it rain, but I cannot just write this off as a hoax, and I really have no idea what could have happened here. Believe it or not, even the Unsolved Mysteries crew had their own odd experience. This segment is available on one of the Unsolved Mysteries DVD sets and features a commentary track from the original director, David Vassar. Vassar claims that he and the rest of the crew traveled to Stroudsburg to film this segment, and that after the last day of shooting, they all woke up in their respective hotel rooms and discovered a half inch of water on the floors. Nobody could figure out where the water came from, and apparently, this did not occur in any of the other rooms at the hotel besides theirs. I mean, even though this is not true crime, I honestly think I could probably do a full-fledged podcast episode on this story, because it's really difficult to come up with a concrete explanation for everything that happened here. I guess that's why I consider Rain Boy to be the ultimate guilty pleasure segment. As silly as this story may be, there are elements about it which are oddly credible. But perhaps my favorite detail is the ironic postscript to this story, because in 2012, Dawn Decker wound up getting arrested again. And the crime Rain Boy was charged with? Arson. Anyway, that about brings an end to this month's bonus Patreon episode, and it was an absolute blast to record this one. I could probably do another one of these episodes about Unsolved Mystery segments which are just plain stupid, such as the notorious fertility statue segment, but I thought I would focus on the guilty pleasure angle, because all these segments are quite fun to watch, and even though some of them are not easily available for viewing, I'd recommend checking them out. Once again, thank you all so much for your support, and have yourself a great month, and join us again in March for our next bonus episode of The Trail Went Cold.